Morning. We are delighted to welcome you all, but a special welcome to the students from Wisconsin Lutheran High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And under this program, students across the state are invited to attend an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case, and they are going to come, listen to an oral argument, and at the end of the second oral argument today, they will meet with a justice of the court who has been assigned to meet with them for this purpose. Does everyone here know enough about the case? If not, we have a summary of the case that we will supply. It's easier to listen to oral argument if you know the facts and the issue of law. Does anyone want a summary? Would you raise your hand, please? Thank you. Everyone is invited to meet with the students and the justice after this second oral argument. The discussion will focus on the procedures of the court in taking and deciding a case, not on the substantive issues that are presented in these cases. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to him, to her, is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And you will meet with Justice Rogensack after the second argument. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'm going to call our first case today, 07AP1868, Johnson Controls, Inc. versus London Market. Let me call the lineup so we're all working off the same chart. We'll hear first from Attorney Tindall for 19 minutes on representing London Market. Then we will hear from the amicus curiae, Attorney Ann Roman Kearney. We will then hear from Mark Thompson for 30 minutes. And then Ms. Tindall, have 5 minutes in rebuttal. All right. Elsa, you may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There are two issues before the court on this case this morning. The first is whether London Market had an obligation to defend Johnson Controls, and the second is whether, if such a duty existed, whether it could be triggered before the exhaustion of the underlying traveler's policy. The answer to both questions is found in the language of the London Market policy, and the answer to both questions is no. The court has explained on many occasions that when we're considering insurance coverage issues like we are here, we have to focus on the specific language of the policy in front of us. And as this court explained in the American Girl case, the place to start in a policy is the coverage grant. It's there where the insurance company sets forth its promises of what it is willing to deliver in exchange for the premium dollars. And the remainder of the policy the definitions, the exclusions, and the conditions, refine that coverage and explain the scope of it, but it's the insuring agreement that lays out the exact promise of the insurer. And here, the insuring agreement promises only to indemnify Johnson Controls. There is no promise of a defense. And in our view, the dispute ends there. There being no promise of a defense, there should be no defense, and the circuit court was wrong in finding that there was one. The circuit court's decision to find a duty to defend was based on the court's analysis of the so-called follow form provision, which I, of course, left in there. That's actually a maintenance of underlying insurance provision that's found in the London Market policy. And it says this policy, the London Market policy, is subject to the same terms, definitions, exclusions, and conditions, except as regards the premium, the amount and limits of liability, and except as otherwise provided herein, as are contained in or as may be added to the underlying umbrella policies, that is, the traveler's policies that are underneath the London Market policy.
Counsel, although the circuit court touched upon briefly two items of parole evidence, it did not appear that the circuit court found an ambiguity. However, what is your response to the idea that the follow form provision may at least create an ambiguity and that there might be two reasonable interpretations, one where indemnification is what is expressly referred to in the policy, but the other, because of the follow form provision, incorporating a term requiring a defense?
Well, first of all, the parties agreed in the briefing at the circuit court level that the policy is unambiguous. So our first argument is everybody had agreed below, and the circuit court found that it was unambiguous. But I think the circuit court's analysis of the policy was erroneous, and I think it's easier to explain it in a different way. We're all familiar with a general liability policy. I'm sure the students aren't, but lucky them, maybe they will be after today. We're familiar with the general liability policy, and it starts off with the coverage grant, and usually with the primary policy, it includes a promise of defense and a promise of indemnity. That's followed by the exclusions. And then the next section is who is the insured. The next section is the limits of liability, followed by the conditions. And then at the end of the policy form is the definitions. Now, if you look at the London Market policy, you don't see all of those sections. There is the jacket cover, and there is some endorsement provisions. And then there is the body of the policy, which consists of basically the insuring agreement, and the maintenance of underlying policy conditions and the limits of liability provisions. There are a few other provisions as well, but you don't see the list of exclusions. There isn't a section about who is an insured. There isn't a list of definitions the same way as there is in the underlying policy or in a typical CGL policy. And it's that, when you look at the policy and you say, except as otherwise provided herein, well, the definitions aren't provided herein. The exclusions aren't provided herein in the London Market policy. Those are the things that are incorporated from the underlying policy. But the insuring agreement is otherwise provided herein. The insuring agreement is front and center, and it promises only indemnity.
The traveler's policy promised a defense.
It does. And it's
and the London Market policy was in excess of the traveler's policy.
Yes, it was.
And with the follow form provision, is there no way that it could be that there could be a reading that through the follow form provision that the duty to defend would be imported to the excess policy of London Market? There's simply no way that could be read in that fashion.
Not in accordance with Wisconsin rules of insurance policy construction. And, you know, this court said in Katz versus Randolph and Scott that we have these well-settled rules of construction, and we're not going to sweep them out. We're going to adhere to them. And how do we construe policies in Wisconsin? First, we don't construe them in a vacuum. We consider the nature and purpose of the policy when we're considering what the policy means. And if you consider
this. First, you look at the language, right?
Yes, of course. First is the language. Language is the touchstone, and the specific language, of course, is the touchstone of all policy interpretation. But when you're construing the language, you don't just consider it in a vacuum. You have to consider, what is this policy meant for? And in our state, we have honored the Olhaven case, the Davis case. There's any number of cases that have considered primary versus excess issues. And when there is a true excess policy, and that term is defined in Olhaven, there's some squabbling in the briefs apparently about what is a true excess policy, but that question is answered in the Olhaven case. And in Olhaven, it says that a true excess policy is one that's written to be specifically in excess of another policy. And here, the traveler's policy is an excess policy because it lists, I think there's 14 policies that it sits in excess of. Then there is the traveler's policy, and then there is our policy, and I believe there is policies above that. So based on the Olhaven definition, we are sitting in the third position up, and that, according to Olhaven, has to be part of the consideration. That an insured has different expectations when reviewing an excess policy as opposed to when construing or considering a primary policy.
You use the general rules of that you interpret the policy as the reasonable expectation of the insured. Does that apply to an excess policy?
Yes. And in our view, no reasonable insured would have an expectation that a third layer excess policy would have a primary obligation to defend. And I think if you think of examples, it makes it easier to understand. If someone slips and falls in the lobby at Johnson Controls and they break their leg, that claim may have a value, but it would not rise to the $7 million of the traveler's policy. So in that circumstance, what the ordinary procedure, as laid out in the Asco-Hennis case and as has been followed by Wisconsin insureds and insurers as long as there's been excess policies, has been that the primary insurer comes in. The primary insurer has those primary obligations of defense and investigation and settlement within policy limits if covered. And the excess insurer usually takes no part. They may be notified, but they're not an active participant. And usually the excess insurer is really only either brought into the suit if the plaintiffs think it might go into the excess limits, but they're usually not they're not as active in these primary type of claims. What plaintiffs are arguing here is that every insurer has a primary duty to defend in this state unless it's specifically excluded, so that every time someone slips and falls at Johnson Controls, they're saying that London Market should come in and file a deck action and say, our limits sit above $7 million, and even if there's liability and coverage, we can't be responsible. Please so declare. And in our view, that's unnecessary. That we're in a period of time when the economy is in tough shape, and people, even the courts are cutting budgets, to require everyone to require all excess insurers to come in and seek a declaration of rights every time that there's any type of claim at all, as is advocated by Johnson Controls, would lead to needless litigation. Our system has been working in this manner without the need for requiring excess insurers to perform this obligation for any number of years.
Well, I'm surprised that you put up in this placard. Maybe we should turn it around, Marshall, so the students can see it.
It's not. That's...
That's yours. Okay. You've seen that then. Well, and why, I was going to ask you why you didn't put up, since it's not your responsibility, the follow form provision.
I believe they have it.
Okay. Well, but this policy, I'm reading it from the appendix. You referred to it. This policy is subject to the same terms, definitions, exclusions, and conditions, except premium and limits of liability, and except as otherwise provided, as are contained in the underlying umbrella, which is travelers' policies, right? Now, as I understand it, the umbrella policy has a duty to defend.
That is correct in its insuring agreement. But our policy includes its own insuring agreement, and that's why it is otherwise provided herein.
And what does that say?
What does what say?
Otherwise provided herein that excludes your duty to defend.
Well, I think you have to consider this provision and the policy as a whole. And so it says that this policy, the London market policy, is subject to the same terms, definitions, exclusions, and conditions.
Right.
And so those are the lists, essentially, that we talked about. Who is an insured, the definitions, the exclusions, and the conditions sections. Those aren't included in our brief. Those are the things that
this
are
This is a reference to specific provisions in the policy.
And it doesn't reference only specific provisions. It says, except as regards to the premiums, the amounts and limits of liability, and except as otherwise provided in this policy. So here, the insuring agreement, we have put in our own insuring agreement, and we have said we're willing to provide indemnity, we are not willing to provide defense, and that is otherwise provided. And in a similar vein, for example,
I want to know where in your policy you say you don't provide a duty of defense.
We did not specifically promise a defense. There is no promise of a defense.
There's no negation. There's no affirmative.
But
but you don't think it's part of the terms?
No, because we have provided our own insuring agreement. And an insuring agreement is a special part of the policy. That's where the insurer lays out what it's selling in exchange for the premium dollars. And here we were selling only indemnity, and that is specified in our indemnity, our insuring agreement. So the things that we did not include in our policy, the list of declaration, the list of exclusions, the list of definitions, those are incorporated. But the things that we put in our policy, including our indemnity agreement or those our insuring agreement and the specific other provisions we put in, those are included. Otherwise, you know, if we intended to just take the traveler's insuring agreement and that to stand as our insuring agreement, that would have been treated the same way as the definitions or exclusions. Then we would not have put in a separate insuring agreement. But we did have our own insuring agreement with one promise, only indemnity and not defense. And that's why the circuit court made a mistake. The circuit court focused solely on except as otherwise provided herein and said, absent a specific exclusion, then it's included. Despite the fact that you've put other language in your policy, you've put your own insuring agreement in, we're still gonna take that out and put in travelers. But what that requires the court to do is to remove our insuring agreement, render it surplusage, and take up travelers. And that's contrary to Wisconsin insurance policy construction.
If I went through the London market policy, and read it, all the fine print, would I be able to easily identify what is meant by terms?
Well, I think that
I have to go through the traveler's policy too.
You would have to.
So would I be easily be able to identify terms, definitions, exclusions, and conditions? I mean, are they so specified that they'll bounce out at me and I can easily do that?
Well, I don't. There isn't a section labeled terms precisely.
Okay.
So no, that isn't.
What about a section labeled conditions?
There is, and there is a definition section as well as an exclusion section. But you know,
But terms is very general.
Terms is more general, and it would refer to the things that are not otherwise provided in the London market policy. Like our notice provision. We have a notice provision, but it doesn't say this is our notice provision and we specifically reject the traveler's provision. And so in order to incorporate our notice provision, you would say that is otherwise provided, even though it's a term. And in our view, the duty to defend is a duty. There's a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify. Those are separate things.
Is that a term of the contract?
I believe it's a duty in the contract or a promise in the contract that's not included. But even if the court was to consider it a term, it is otherwise provided because we put in our own insuring agreement.
Counsel, this case has several friends of the court filing briefs here, and one is from the Complex Insurance Claim Litigation Association. And when I was looking at that, I thought to myself, interesting. You know, a contract of insurance, a policy of insurance is nothing more than a contract. It is a legally binding contract between the parties. Yet most of the cases that we have, even in the Supreme Court, don't afford an opportunity for an amicus from the Complex Insurance Claims Litigation Association. Most of our cases involve what I would call more mom-and-pop policies, but nevertheless, they're contracts. We have certain rules about, and when I say mom-and-pop, I mean underinsured, uninsured, a smaller claim, smaller under a CGL policy. But we have rules of contract construction. One that we adhere to in cases, can give a litany of cases, that if there's ambiguity, the policy is construed in favor of the insured, construed for coverage. Does that canon of interpretation of insurance policies change at all because we're dealing with pretty sophisticated parties and complex litigation?
It does in a way, because the way the rule is formulated is that we construe the policy from the standpoint of a reasonable person in the position of the insured. And the reasonable person in the position of the insured who would buy a layered, there's a number of layers of coverage, that isn't a mom and pop or a family who's buying a primary policy for their car and an umbrella policy for extra protection. When you have this kind of a layered insurance program, you're dealing with a sophisticated corporation who knows what it's purchasing, understands the terms and conditions of its policies. So the standpoint of a reasonable position is a little elevated in a case like this, not based on any change in the law, but just based on, again, we don't consider the policies in a vacuum. We consider the nature and purpose of the policies, and we honor the layering programs that insureds put together. And the case law in Wisconsin has said repeatedly, we understand that insureds buy these layering programs. They want the policies to provide certain things, and that's what they do.
Chief, if I may just... in essence, you're saying the canons of construction for insurance policies are the same. If there's ambiguity, then it's construed in favor of coverage for the insured. Here, when considering the purpose of the insurance, the application of that rule plays out differently, perhaps, but the canons are all the same, regardless if it's big or little, complex or simple. Is that correct?
I think so, and I think a good analysis is found in the Folkman case, which explains our rules and talks about how the policy is construed from the position of the insured. But the Folkman case, I think, is particularly on point here, because in that case, there was a provision in the policy that was drafted by the insurer but placed in the wrong section. And the insured argued, well, that makes the limits of liability provision ambiguous to us, and therefore we want this policy construed in our favor and we want more policy limits. And this court said policies don't have to be drafted perfectly. If there's only one reasonable interpretation of the policy language, that's what we go with. And the court said in that particular case, the insured selected the policy limits. And because the insured is aware of what they were purchasing and they selected the limits, the insured is bound by those limits and we're not going to construe the policy differently. And that's the same in this case, where the insured selected these policies, the insured selected the limits, and in our view, a reasonable insured does not expect a primary defense or any defense from a third layer excess when we provide that we only are come into play when the underlying policies are exhausted. And I see my time is up, and I will let Attorney Kearney address the exhaustion issue.
Thank you, Ms. Tindall. Good morning, Ms. Kearney. You're representing the Appellate Consulting Group as amicus.
Yes, Your Honors, but actually I represent defendants interveners.
Okay.
And so you're,
so you're not amicus. You're
yes,
defenders.
You're actually okay. Defendants Thank interveners, you. Your Honors. No duties, Your Honors, should be imposed upon defendant interveners or London Market until there has been proper exhaustion of underlying insurance. The second question certified by the Court of Appeals is as follows. Is the excess liability carrier's duty to defend primary in nature, such that it may be triggered even if the excess policy expressly requires exhaustion of the underlying policy as a precondition to liability, and the underlying policy has not been exhausted? The answer, again, Your Honors, is no. Simply put, the excess carrier's duty to defend is not primary in nature, as you've heard from Ms. Tindall. Exhaustion of underlying insurance is found in the express terms of the excess policies at issue, and those terms should be enforced. Indeed, exhaustion is a precondition to coverage in defendant intervention.
What do you mean
policy.
By exhaustion? You mean that all of the proceeds of the policy have to have been paid out?
There has to be a determination of liability, a judgment has to be entered, or there has to be some sort of settlement. Yes.
Wasn't there a settlement here?
Only with the primary carrier, Your Honors, and that settlement was with one of the primary carriers. And in fact, that's what shows that this system works in the layered way that we've talked about here. What happened was Johnson Controls, its actions show it went after the primary carrier for a duty to defend. And there was some problems. They actually sued for breach, and then they sued for breach of good faith, in fact. And then there was a settlement. And from there on, after they went to the primary care for that duty to defend, now they're seeking, or they went to the umbrella layer, which is that next layer, only after exhaustion. The fact is, though, Your Honors, it is Johnson Controls' burden to show exhaustion, and they have not shown exhaustion here. And because
How should
of
they
that,
have shown exhaustion?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
How should they have shown exhaustion?
They have to show that it's reached the point where those limits of liability of the upper parties attach. Our limits start at $17 million. So they would have to show that by the time they get to that they have reached the $17 million mark to go to defendants interveners, and then we see whether or not there is coverage in play there, given our policies and the express terms of our policies. And we're looking just at indemnification there, Your Honors, because of what the express terms of those contracts provide. Just indemnification. Nowhere is there a duty to defend without exhaustion, without a showing by Johnson Controls of what it must do. I wish to note, by the way, I did look in the record within the last 2 weeks, and defendants interveners' policies are, in fact, and at least a number of them, are in the rather lengthy record on appeal. I talked about Johnson Controls' actions, and they're pretty clear from actually starting out with their actual complaint in this case. They bought a system of insurance, and they label it in categories, primary excess, primary umbrella, and excess. And that's how they've acted in this case. And we believe, actually in this instance, that their actions were appropriate because case law in Wisconsin recognizes the pattern of insurance. As we heard in Olhaven, there are layers. There are layers of insurance, and there are distinctions between those layers. The primary layer is where you start, as Your Honors have said in many cases.
And how much was it in this case? What was the primary layer?
The coverage chart, Your Honor, is all over the board. And frankly, we don't know because we don't have the settlements in the record what they settled for. Our understanding, it wasn't the limits, but we don't know, Your Honor. So we can't tell without
which
them
limits.
Proving
it wasn't which limits.
I'm sorry?
It wasn't which limits. It wasn't the limits of the primary. It wasn't the limits of the umbrella.
Your Honor, the settlements that they've reached with other parties are not part of the record here. We don't know what they've settled. All we know is that they settled with one of their primary carriers, WASA. We don't know what the settlement is. And then they started to go after the umbrella, and we, too, are not privy to what that information is. All we know is that they haven't proved yet in an action that they have reached our limits where our limits should attach. And that is their burden as the one seeking to have this precondition satisfied so that they can get to the next layer here.
Counsel, does an excess carrier ever have the right to be involved in a lawsuit? Let's say you knew this was going to be a $50 million lawsuit. And so you knew that, I mean, you could reasonably believe it's not just a slip and fall in the lobby. It's something that could rise to that level. Would you have the right to defend since you really thought that your policy was going to be invoked?
Your Honor, certainly there's the ability to associate so that we are kept monitoring. But that duty to defend is a primary duty to defend. And the primary goes in there. Certainly people monitor, but they control it. And that's really what this court's case law has sought to get. There are powerful incentives in this court's law that says the primary goes in and the primary is supposed to act. And if they don't, they're acting at their own peril.
And yours, perhaps, if you don't like the way they're defending.
Sometimes there's a mess at the end. There's no doubt about it. But what is
so as an excess carrier, the answer to my question is you really don't have any right to be involved or defend in the lawsuit.
No, we don't, unless there is something expressly in the policy that allows for that. And that's really what we're asking Your Honors to honor here, which is enforce the terms of the policy that are expressly there. Can I conceive of a situation where there's an express policy that's been bought and premium paid, where there's a duty to defend? Yes. Usually, and most always, there's a condition of exhaustion before that has to happen. So it all depends on what the terms of that policy are. And the fact is,
counsel, isn't there a difference between duty to defend and opportunity to defend? If I were on an umbrella I'd fly away, I suppose. But if I were on an umbrella or an excess policy and I was a named defendant in the action, and I had great concerns about my exposure and what was going on in the underlying primary, either the ability of the defense attorney or the arguments being advanced, and I had faced great monetary exposure. Even if I didn't have the duty to defend, wouldn't I have the ability to defend?
Only if we could convince people like Your Honors that we should be defendants interveners. We'd have to somehow be able to intervene, or the policy would have to provide that we have the right to do that. But ordinarily, in the ordinary case, it is the primary that has that duty, and they have that they control the litigation there. So
even when you're a named defendant, you're saying?
That's how the system works, the way that we have this layered system. And I think it works well, Your Honors. I see that my time is up.
I have a question for you. If you were writing this opinion, how would you write it?
I would write it, Your Honor, that you can't imply a duty in a contract, that the express terms of that contract should control. And the express terms here do not have a duty to defend. And that's how the system in this state works, that the state has a layered system where the primary has that duty and the incentives are there for the primary to come in, and also that there are conditions like exhaustion that have to be honored and enforced. And when it comes to the time when that condition kicks in, the insured has to show that that condition is satisfied, and then we move to the next step, the excess carrier.
And are you automatically liable if the primary has been held liable?
No, Your Honor, we're not ordinarily liable. It all goes based on what our policy provides there. We have our defenses just like everybody else. It may be that those defenses aren't applicable there, but no, there is still the litigation that might come. But what it does is say that you're within our limits, and at that point, you know, there are all the options available both to the insured and the insurer to decide whether there's coverage or, you know, whether there's settlement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Carey.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Bob Thompson. I'm here with Brett Eckstein, my partner William Cannon, and Jerry Okarma, Vice President and General Counsel of Johnson Controls. As on its prior appeal, Johnson Control asked only that its reasonable expectation for a defense be recognized. Well-established law provides that where the plain, or at worst ambiguous, language of an insurance policy incorporates a duty to defend and the underlying insurer breaches that duty, a duty to drop down and defend exists for the excess and umbrella insurer. This principle conforms to the foundational duty to defend law that explains the broader importance of protecting the insured against potential exposure and ensures that the insurance layering sees the insured through the utmost hour of need.
Counselor, if we buy your argument, aren't we really in danger of serving the insured less well than what has been going on in the past, in that if the excess has a duty to defend, then what's to keep the primary and the first umbrella, which also in their policies contain such a duty, from simply refusing to do so and bumping the costs upward, therefore increasing litigation for your client without the duty to defend that the client should have?
The easiest case or that I can refer the court to is the Southeast Wisconsin Professional Baseball Stadium Park District case. There, because Federal had a duty, it did drop down to defend. It was entitled to reimbursement as against the travelers. It recouped all its expenses. There is a significant penalty for a primary if it breaches its duty. The balancing is to allow the excess to escape the duty would leave the insured, as it did in this case, Johnson Controls, without a defense and in need.
Why were they without a defense when Travelers provides a defense in their policy and so did the Wausau policy? I'm a little lost on that.
And this will take us back to the beginning, and it's tied directly to this court's last decision. Last time, the court said unequivocally that when Johnson Controls conveyed its claims from the EPA or the PRP letters or the DNR, it reasonably expected a defense. What had happened was prior to 1989, when this lawsuit was initiated, Johnson Controls did in fact send its claims to its insurers, including Travelers and London Market here. What happened, however, is that Travelers did not defend, neither did London Market, nor did any other insured. And now we are some quarter century later, and we are now trying to recover damages that resulted from that loss and that breach.
Wasn't that, though, because of the earlier case of this court, which said there wasn't a duty to defend on a cleanup, an environmental cleanup?
Not at all. As this court was very clear in its last decision, prior to this court's ruling in Edgerton, the common law held that such damages were recoverable. The majority decision around the country is that such damages were recoverable. And in fact, in 1992, the Court of Appeals specifically said that such damages were coverable. And even then, neither Travelers nor London Market showed up to defend. Even when the law in this state said that a DNR or PRP letter. So what we're talking now, and what this court has to decide, is what is Johnson Controls' remedy, given the plain meaning of this policy?
Counselor, I just want to be sure I understand the facts. Was this case tendered to London Market when it began? I thought it wasn't tendered until 2006, and I may have misunderstood.
No, it was tendered.
When they were first sued.
It was even tendered before then.
Well, when they got the notice.
When Johnson Controls received its PRP letters,
right,
and the DNR letters, they conveyed those claims to its insureds.
All of them. So
all
Wausau,
of their insureds.
Travelers, and London all got notice.
All of their insureds.
Okay, thanks.
And consistent with this court's decision, that triggers the duty to defend. So then the question becomes, and we submit that the plain language of this policy, if I may, Your Honor, could I turn the charts
yes,
around?
Yes,
that a plain reading of this policy incorporates a duty. First of all, we start with the insuring agreement. The insuring agreement says, subject to the limitations, terms, and conditions here and after mentioned, to indemnify the insured. But within that insuring agreement, it says that insuring agreement is subject to the limitations, terms, and conditions. To indemnify the insured for property damage, I'm sort of skipping here, and arising out of the hazards covered by and as defined in the underlying umbrella policies and issued by the insurers stated in item 2, and for purposes of this, that is Travelers. And on this record, for the purpose of, with respect to these claims, Travelers is essentially primary, and London Market sits immediately above Travelers. We then go to the condition that the insuring agreement says it's subject to. And there we find the follow form, which what's called the follow form provision. This is the maintenance of underlying liability provision. But this condition, which is part of the insuring agreement, specifically states, and from the reasonable insureds, whether it's Johnson Controls or the person buying a car, this court's never made a distinction in terms of who's reading it. This policy is subject to the same terms, definitions, exclusions, and conditions, except as regards the premium, the amount and limits of liability, and except as otherwise provided herein, as are contained in or as may be added to the underlying umbrella policies stated in item 2 of the declarations, the Travelers policies, prior to the happening of an occurrence for which claim is made hereunder. Before I go to the defense provision, which incorporates, I'd like to just touch on, while we're looking at this, they accept as regards the premium, and if you compare the London policy and the Travelers policy, they do both reference the premium separately. They also reference the amount and limits of liability. But that, too, is identified in both policies. So why do they accept that? I submit that because absent that exception, when you get to the follow form that says we will, this policy follows the same terms and terms, definitions, and exclusions of Travelers, they were worried about a potential ambiguity even on that question. And to make sure that there was no ambiguity or that Johnson Controls could somehow unfairly expand the scope of its coverage, they accepted it. And so then you go to, and accept as otherwise provided herein. And as the court noted, if you review the whole policy, there is nothing in the London policy that says except as otherwise provided herein. Now, the A.O. Smith Court of Appeals decision is the only case that we could find that touched on this follow form provision. And it didn't address the question clearly. But in A.O. Smith, applying principles articulated under Wisconsin law, it looked at the excess and the underlying, utilizing the follow form, to look at and develop a principle that says we put the two policies side by side, and unless the policy, the excess, excludes it, it becomes incorporated in. The General Accident Safety National case that we cite specifically did the same analysis, and it said that a follow form specifically incorporates all the terms, absent an exception. And when you look at, and let me, London Market also cites Home Insurance Company, a Second Circuit case, where the court specifically said when we're looking at both policies, where there's inconsistency between the excess and the underlying, then the excess trumps, given the rules and purposes of excess and umbrella insurance. But absent that will be read together, and the underlying, the excess carrier will incorporate all the terms and conditions. Then we turn to what, with respect to the defense, London Market Incorporated. It specifically says...
This is the traveler's policy.
This is the traveler's defense provision. The company shall have the right and duty to defend any suit against the insured seeking damages on account of such injury or damage, and may make such investigation and settlement of any claim or suit as it deems expedient, but the company shall not be obligated to pay any claim or judgment or to defend any suit filed after the applicable limit of the company's liability has been exhausted.
Is that in the insuring section of the agreement? I frankly couldn't read the policies that you put in the appendix, and I had my judicial assistant try to get them out of the record, and they weren't much better as far as legibility is concerned.
The traveler's defense provision is in the first term that states liability.
Well, is it in the insuring agreement section of the policy? In other words, that's what I'm asking.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, good. Thanks. That's all
And essentially, what you have as a result of the incorporation, plainly stated, is that London Market did incorporate such a duty. And that's why we say it's primary. Now, this is also consistent with the purpose of excess or umbrella insurance. No one denies, London Market, the other companies, do not deny that an excess policy may provide for a duty to defend. Johnson Controls has never said that this court's ruling would mean that every policy would have to have one, because it's very clear that if you exclude it, it's out. Whether the duty to defend exists in each case depends on the plain meaning of the language at issue. And so now we go back to the purpose. Olhafen and Treader, Court of Appeals decisions, can give us some insight as to the purpose. Olhafen says the purpose of excess or umbrella insurance is to protect and provide security, additional security for the insured. Here, Johnson Controls.
Could I ask this? Ms. Tindall gave a hypothetical of someone slipping and falling in the lobby of Johnson Controls. So if all these policies were in place, the injured party, represented by Cannon and Dunphy, files the lawsuit. When does the excess company, when is the duty to defend triggered for that excess company?
This court answered that question clearly in its last decision. When the insured or Johnson Controls conveys that claim to the insurer. Now, that is when this notion of when does the notice go on. Thereafter, Town Realty and its progeny has been absolutely clear. If an insurer is unclear whether or not there's to apply a defense, they need to ask. Hocker, of the 10th Circuit decision where there was a drop-down duty, was exactly that case. Personal injury action, where both insurers didn't even tell their insureds that they weren't defending, default judgment, and the court said there they had a drop-down duty.
So let me understand here. Unless there's an explicit exclusion of some sort, if Johnson Controls tenders something to all of its insurers, they all have to defend?
No. And I think there are two things that have sort of been thrown out there as a red herring by London Market. The question is, when does the duty arise? It is with the conveyance. When does the obligation start? It starts depending on what's happening below. If the primary defends, the excess has no need to drop down. It has no obligation to drop down. But it has ensured that its insured has the defense at its utmost time of need. So the question of the application of the duty then is subject to what's going on below. So there is no position that the excess carrier has to defend in every case. Where the primary is not breaching its duty, and there is a provision that its duty does not exhaust, as in this case, the traveler's duty, which...
Just counsel, you have to stay by the microphone. Yes, thank you.
Yes. As I was saying, the traveler's duty was relieved at the point of exhaustion. Now, that is the primary duty London Market incorporated. So the exhaustion of limits has nothing to do with the, in this case, when the duty arises.
So you're not complaining that London Market didn't help you in your original settlement?
That is the other question that we really need to talk about.
Because the settlement, that is, as I understand, Justice Prosser's argument. He's saying, when did your duty to defend start? And I'm asking you.
All right. The question of settlement in this case is completely unrelated to the question of exhaustion. Okay, because what we're talking about, and I believe that there was the Court of Appeals certification stated that, but it sort of fuzzed the question. In this case, there was no settlement until after this court ruled, 20-some years after the duty had been breached, after the duty had arisen.
Which and duty are we talking about now?
The duty to defend.
Okay.
If I may address the court to the record at 1487. That was the fourth supplemental RCMO at the last time Johnson Controls updated its alleged total damages, which exceeded some $134 million. There was no settlement at the time the claims were conveyed 25 years ago. There was no settlement until after this court ruled that there was a duty, and now Johnson Controls is in the process of being made whole and recovering for the damages it incurred a quarter century ago is fundamentally different than the exhaustion issue. If 25 years ago Johnson Controls would have been faced with a situation where Travelers did defend and then reached a settlement, would that have ended London Market's duty to defend? Yes. But that's not what occurred. I mean, that happens all the time. I mean, this court addressed it in Teagan, where, and that's where the an excess insurer cried foul because there was no exhaustion. This court said,
Counselor, wait. Did I misunderstand you? I thought you said that you settled with Travelers, but I thought there was just a settlement with Wausau.
No, the record does reflect their settlements with other insurers. The settlements with other insurers are 20-some years after the alleged breach.
All that may be true. I just want to be sure I understand the facts,
Okay.
That's all.
And
all of 2006, I believe.
Yeah.
So Travelers was settled out, too?
Yes.
Okay, thank
okay.
you. Thank
And the point, though, is that the settlement with Travelers 20 years after the breach has nothing to do with exhaustion, because at the time, Travelers said they had no defense, they didn't drop down, there could be no exhaustion. That's where Southeast and Hawker say that you have a duty to drop down. If I also may address the point about the limits of liability that they talk about.
Counsel, can I just ask you something quickly before? Ms. Tyndall referenced that there was an agreement before the circuit court that this was unambiguous. Is that true? That the language at issue is unambiguous?
Johnson Controls has consistently argued that the plain meaning of this policy does incorporate a duty to defend. Applying principles articulated in Olhaven and Trader, where you construe the whole policy and the purposes. Okay. We have also argued that absent that, Johnson Controls had a reasonable interpretation, and it's at worst ambiguous and consistent with the decision in Aetna versus Lloyd's, which addressed a very similar policy. That court said it was ambiguous. And even in that case, the accept provision accepted defense costs and accepted the investigation of a defense. And in that case, the court said, construing the policies as a whole, they are still ambiguous, and London Market had a duty to defend.
So do I understand you correctly? You are arguing it's ambiguous, and you did before the circuit court, or was it that the parties agreed that it was unambiguous? I heard you say, we agreed that the plain language says X, but if it doesn't say X, then it's ambiguous and interpret it in favor of the insured.
We have argued consistently. I'm unaware where there was an agreement. Both parties argued that it was unambiguous, the plain meaning that the circuit courts took a reasonable approach, that if you look at the policy from the reasonable expectations of Johnson Controls, there is nothing in the excess policy that would put Johnson Controls on notice that it would not have a duty to defend.
Then let me just also clarify something in my mind. If Travelers settles or pays their limit, then under your view, the excess insurance carrier, London, has an obligation to come in and defend, right?
The whole question of payment or settlements is a question of the timing of when those take place. What we have is, in this case, in late 80s, Johnson Controls conveyed its letters, claims, to all the insurers. They were not provided with a defense. They were left to fend on their own.
I'm just asking you, I'm going slower than you are. You're ahead of me here. If they settle, whether it's 2006 or back then, I'm not necessarily in the facts of this case, but if they settle or pay the limits, then the next tier has to kick in and defend. Is that the general rule that you're proposing?
Well, typically, the law is that where there is a continuing claim and the primary does, in fact, defend and does pay and exhaust its limits, and the claim continues.
Or settles, right,
and the claim continues, but in settlement exhausts its limits, then the duty, London Market, does have the duty. This is a question of under what circumstances do they have the obligation to defend.
So if that company, somewhere in the tier, doesn't defend, you're saying the excess carrier better step in and start defending, because otherwise 25 years later, they're going to be found responsible for not defending in the first instance.
And that depends on the question this court's going to decide, whether the language of that excess carrier provides a duty to defend. And
in the first instance, if the people below blow it and they don't defend, and they're supposed to be defending, they're the primary policy, bad faith, whatever it is, they don't defend, the excess carriers better step in and start defending, because otherwise, 25 years later, they're responsible. Right? If unless I'm missing something.
Right. That's potentially. The case law is very, very clear that the excess carrier has the right to do several things. It has the right to agree with a non-waiver agreement. It has the reservation of rights to defend with a reservation of rights. It has a right to seek a declaratory action. All of those allow them to defend and take care of Johnson Controls at its time of need, or any insured in its time of need.
Mr. Thompson, let me interrupt you for a minute. Is there a burden to show exhaustion?
No. Not in this context, and not as it relates to the duty to defend.
Why or why not?
This court's decision last time triggered the duty to defend on the conveyance.
When you're talking about this court's decision last time, you're talking about the Johnson Controls case.
Correct, I'm sorry. 2003 case.
Okay.
I apologize. Could you just give me that question again? I just lost it.
I'm asking, is there a burden? If yes, or if no, tell me what your position is burden. You seem to respond there was no burden.
There was no exhaustion. Under these facts, where the primary breaches, there is no determination. And I would just direct the courts to General Accident and Safety National, where the court looked at a policy and said the duty to indemnify or limits of liability have to do with indemnity and has nothing to do with the scope and nature of the duty to defense. They're two completely different questions. So there is, in the process of construing this policy, is there anything in these two policies when put them together that would put Johnson Controls on notice that in the event the primary breaches, that there was no duty to defend? We say they expressly adopted it. Again, exhaustion is not a burden. Town Realty is very clear that if there is a question, that obligation falls on the insurer to clarify. For example, let's just back up a quarter century. When these letters were tendered, and if it was the position that London Market believed, as it's articulated here today, that Travelers had the primary duty to defend, like Federal in the stadium case, all they would have had to do is go to the circuit court and say, we have been asked to defend these various claims. We are defending under a reservation of rights. We, however, believe, and Johnson Controls believes, that Travelers has a primary duty or an initial duty to defend. And we are defending under our secondary drop-down duty, but we want an order that Travelers assume the duty because coverage is fairly debatable under the law. And under the state of the law at the time, pre-this court's decision, Edgerton, it was fairly debatable. I am certain, as did the circuit court in the stadium case, that the circuit court in this case would have ordered Travelers to assume the duty obligations and thereby relieved London Market from that duty and reimbursed it for any of its costs incurred. They didn't do that. Instead, Johnson Controls was left for virtually 20 years without a defense. It incurred millions and tens of millions of dollars of defense costs, remediation costs. But for its stature, it would have been potentially out of business. If this would have been a smaller business, left alone, facing these odds, that's why I go back to the purpose. From the insured's point of view, Old Hafen says it, it's extra coverage. It's extra protection. Trader says it's the last line of defense. Now, the purpose of umbrella or excess, my time is up, Matt.
You may finish your sentence, please.
The purpose of excess insurance, when the dispute is between two insurers, as in Trader or Old Hafen. Old Hafen stands for the proposition that where an excess, BOC there, had a policy that says it will not pay indemnity over and above any other insurance or primary, it was excess. So the purpose protects the excess carrier in disputes and discussions with its other insurers But when it comes to its duties and obligations to the insured, the duty to defend has always been broader than the duty to indemnify. And there is nothing in this policy or public policy that should preclude this court from affirming the trial court's narrow decision that simply applied well-established rules. Nothing radically will change.
Counsel, I have a question. This exhaustion clause, if I read it right, talked about indemnification obligation. It doesn't say anything about the duty to defend.
Absolutely. And that's why when you compare the policies, there is nothing in the excess, the London market policy, that says anything about the duty to defend. And under General Accident and Safety National, the purpose of the limits of liability is in relationship to other carriers and deals with when they trigger their indemnity obligations. Sorry about that. But it says nothing about the duty to defend. The duty to defend has been incorporated.
Now, this is a very strange insurance case from my perspective for the moment. It's the insured who's looking to the language of the policy and saying, I'm covered. And it's the insurance companies who are saying, let's not look at the exact language of the policy. Let's look at the purpose of the policy. That's not the usual posture of the parties. Maybe you don't find it strange. I find it interesting.
I did find it ironic. We believe that this court can affirm applying the plain meaning of the language and rationalize the dual purposes of excess insurance where an excess insurer has a defense obligation without broadly expanding or adopting a radical new view that requires exhaustion in every instance, which would unsettle the law.
I have another question. Exactly what does this give you? If you win this lawsuit, where do you go from here?
If we win this decision, this court has simply said, as the trial court said, that there is a duty to defend under this policy. We go back to the circuit court for proceedings consistent with that agreement to determine whether there is a breach. If there was a breach, what are the damages? And under no circumstances is Johnson Controls entitled to be made more than whole.
But you're not presently being sued by anyone. You've paid off the obligations?
There are some of the sites. This is a very, very complex case. There are several.
I already figured that.
There are some sites that are still incurring. Most of the damages have been incurred, and now we are in the process of being made whole and trying to recover. Johnson Controls is trying to recover its damages at this point in time. And all the settlements to date have simply been meant to do that and are not in any way tied to any exhaustion going back 25 years ago.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. What we have heard from Johnson Controls is the complaint, essentially, that Travelers breached its obligation to defend, but that London Market is supposed to be held responsible for Travelers' breach. London Market never promised to defend. And London Market is saying, look at our policy. And our policy says, if it's otherwise provided herein, and as the American Home case says, if the indemnity agreements clash, the excess insurer's indemnity provision prevails. And we're saying our indemnity provision prevails. We did not provide for any duty to defend.
Is there an obligation to defend if it's not in the policy as a general principle?
No court, nowhere in the United States has there been imposed judicially an obligation to defend. Only in California is there such an obligation that's imposed legislatively, and it's our position that the legislature should be responsible if that's to be an issue here. So it's our position from the get-go. We didn't promise to defend, and our insuring agreement is otherwise provided, and there is no duty to defend and no ambiguity.
What you may have intended, or what your opposing party may have intended, to me is irrelevant. The only thing that's relevant is what the words of this policy mean. And the only thing that's relevant is what a reasonable person in each of your positions would have understood the words to mean. Do you agree with that?
I agree, and I agree that the case law says when construing this kind of provision that where the excess conflicts with the primary, the excess's language prevails.
See, my concern is this case that's been ongoing for years and years and years with all sorts of parties and all sorts of money and up and down to the Supreme Court, you're going to mess up our insurance law. That's my concern.
Exactly.
And I don't want that to happen. So you talk about purpose as though there should be a trial to see if the intent is consistent with the purpose. And as I understand, the purpose, you know, that comes into the analysis, you know, not whether they intended coverage. Sure, they intended it, you know. it's all a matter of what the words and what a reasonable person in the position of the insured would have understood the words to mean. You agree that's the law?
And we have a number of cases that say exactly what a reasonable person in the position of the insured purchasing an excess policy would have expected
the words of the policy to mean, right? And the purpose then comes in the analysis only to inform what the reasonable person would expect the words to mean. In other words, if the purpose of the insurance policy is antithetical to what the interpretation advanced, then it's not a reasonable interpretation. But in that way, the purpose comes in. It's not the same as looking at extrinsic evidence to see what the parties intended. It's what did the parties intend these words to mean.
What kind of policy is this? What does this do?
Okay, well.
And that's based on the language of the policy.
Based on the language. And if it's someone's interpretation is antithetical to the purpose, then the interpretation isn't reasonable, right?
That would be correct because
Likely correct. I mean, I don't want to say that. Yeah,
likely all correct. Other things being equal, yeah. And coverage being and mm-hmm. all those caveats. But yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is your interpretation of the policy can't be divorced from the language. And let's just take for an example.
Your interpretation of the policy is the language, right?
It is the language. But for example, let's take the position that that an excess insurer has a primary duty to defend, and they have an obligation to come in and get a declaration of rights. Oh, but they don't if the primary steps up and does what it's supposed to do. You can see when you formulate the rule in that manner that is utterly divorced from any policy language in any of the policies in issue here. Now, the Hocker case has very different language. The cases that they rely on have very different language from the policies here. But if this court does as we ask, it examines Wisconsin law and Wisconsin rules of interpretation and this policy in accordance with Wisconsin rules, then there's only one result, in our view, no duty to defend and no obligation in any event prior to exhaustion of the underlying limits. And just one quick point with regard to exhaustion. The exhaustion provision states that no liability shall attach. It doesn't say no indemnity or no duty to pay. It says no liability shall attach. Now, Johnson Controls argues that the London market policy has to be construed in reference to the underlying traveler's policy. And if you look at the underlying traveler's policy, the insuring agreement, the very first word of that agreement, which provides for both a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify, is liability. So if the term liability is dependent on what the traveler's policy says, it's clear that travelers considers both the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify as part of liability. That's the very first word in the title of that section. So under that analysis, if that's the way you look at it, then the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify cannot attach until such time as there is exhaustion. And that's that's the reason analysis that has been applied in cases like Ascohennis and Seats Incorporated. Those are Wisconsin cases that we've cited to the court.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank all the counsel for their briefs and their arguments today in yet another interpretation of an insurance policy in a very different environment. And that concludes the hearing on 07-AP-1868, Johnson Controls, Inc. versus London Market. The court will take a brief recess so that these students may leave, and we are expecting another group of students for the second argument. We are in recess.